The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League returns. Kylian Mbappe is good. Messi looks sad again as PSG win 4-1 at the Nou Camp. A big night for Poch and the latest post-mortem into Barcelona's demise. Liverpool get back on the horse in Budapest. Perhaps RB Leipzig studied the Reds' recent defending a little too closely as they set up Salah and Mane. In the Premier League, Thomas Tuchel can even get Timo Werner to score goals, and West Ham are actually good. Like, consistently good. How long can it last? Elsewhere, there's Lou Macari's heroics, a referee starting on players in the EFL, and Podders getting literature acknowledgements. All that, plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, some French. Hello, Philippe Auclair.
Hello, Max Rushton.
Some Scouse. Hello, Andy Hunter.
Hello.
Some Irish. Hello, Barry Glendenning.
Digwith, Max.
Digwith. And for a few minutes, some honorary Spanish. Hello, Sid Lowe.
Hello, Max. How are you?
I'm very good, thanks. Let's start then at the Nou Camp. Barca 1, PSG 4. Christian says, is La Liga a farmer's league? Before we get into the crisis of Barcelona, should we talk about Kylian Mbappe? An Australian friend of mine, Davo, sent me a clip of the international commentary they got, at which point the commentator put his reputation on the line by saying, the future's bright for Kylian Mbappe. Philippe, he was really good yesterday, wasn't he?
He was absolutely magnificent. And he was. It was all the more spectacular that he hadn't been exactly fantastic over the last few months, to be honest. And even you could say since the World Cup in Russia. But that was the best of Mbappe that that we've seen for a very long time. And the best is just absolutely phenomenal. I hope you saw the front page of L'Équipe, by the way, today. And if you haven't, I absolutely implore you all to have a look at it. It's one of the most amazing photographs, and I think one of those which will, you know, remain in our collective psyche and be the symbol of what happened on that night. It's basically, yes, it's the cartoonish picture of Kylian Mbappe with Gerard Piqué desperately trying to hang on to his coattails, and literally to his coattails. And as a friend of ours said, Sam White, actually, you really feel like Kylian Mbappe should have a string of sausages in his mouth running away from the butcher's shop. It's absolutely magnificent. And I think that one of the reasons why you felt so, unless you were a Barca fan, so up after the game is the absolute joy that he seems to exude in his playing. And because he's capable of the fact that he is a marvellous player who is blessed with intelligence, technique, skill, physical ability, all this we know. But one of the things that had changed more recently, certainly in the last, I think the last season of PSG, is that the joy of playing, which has always been something so important for him, was not quite there. And yesterday you had the full Mbappe. You had the Mbappe we discovered with Monaco, who had grown into his role, playing with a kind of freedom that we really see. And it's just, as you say, pure joy to see him at such a level. And surrounded, I mean, because it was not all about Mbappe, but surrounded with players who were, obviously he feels completely attuned to in terms of the way they move around the pitch. And he was just phenomenal. It was just fantastic. It really felt like a game which would remain as an important date in his own story or history. He's only 22 years of age.
Philippe, you used the word last night, that picture, the way that he's running and the way that his arms and his legs are all at right angles. I mean, it really is incredibly cartoonish, and Philippe used the word. And I must admit, it's brilliant because it is a word I think I've never not read since reading the Beano many years ago. Mbappe was scarpering. Yes. It's just gorgeous. The photographs that have come from it, amazing. And this is going to sound stupid because, of course, he's a phenomenal athlete, but that photograph sort of looks unathletic in a way. It looks cartoonish, doesn't it? It doesn't look elegant. It just looks, I don't know what it looks like.
In fact, Sid, what he does is that he's using his arms as levers, as all pure sprinters do. When you look at them with the way that you can see that their hands, the fingers are spread, and you've got these right angles everywhere. Everything is at 90 degrees.
Yeah.
He's a sprinter as well, but he's more than anything, he's an absolutely phenomenal footballer. The finish for the third goal, my goodness. I mean, I don't know. How do you describe that, Max? It's just pleasure, joy.
Yeah. Has Pochettino kind of enabled that? You gave a little idea that Tuchel hasn't. He was less happy under Tuchel. Is that giving Pochettino too much credit? Because it was a massive night for Poch as well.
Yeah, or maybe not enough credit to Tuchel, who took them to a Champions League final and won a treble with them. So, no, Tuchel deserve a lot of credit. The problem with PSG generally are not with the manager, and they're more with the structure of the dynamic within the club, which was really rotten in the last few months of Thomas Tuchel's stay there. Obviously, Poch arriving has changed things for the better, certainly in terms of solidity to start with, and I think has definitely put a bit of joy back into that particular squad. So, whether it is, you know, the Poch effect, I think the Poch effect in some ways is more in evidence for other players in that squad. I think if you tell me about Leandro Paredes, I would say, yeah, definitely, there's a big Poch effect there. If you tell me Verratti playing in that role, I say, yeah, definitely. Marquinhos as well, with all these responsibilities. Florenzi, and there are loads of players who have on whom, obviously, the change of manager seems to have had a very positive effect. But I think for Mbappe, it's more a question of being who he is, and he's been for a very long time being himself again.
Yes, I mean, Spurs fans very excited to watch a Poch team pressing like that when they've got, you know, Jose's welcoming pellets on a Thursday night. But anyway, Barry Jenkins says, does the panel think this was the first time watching PSG that they genuinely look like a European superpower? I mean, it's something you've wanted to happen for ages. You've always talked them up. Could this be the moment?
Not even I am going to suggest that they may bottle this one. I mean, they were so completely superior last night that not even PSG can blow this or do a PSG on this one, I think. Although it would be hilarious if they did. But, I mean, I was just thinking when I woke up this morning, I was thinking, you know, I would generally quite happily swap places with Gerard Piqué, but this morning I was really glad I wasn't Gerard Piqué. I mean, he's everything I'm not, but I didn't want to be him this morning. Him and Sergino Dest must have woken up thinking they'd had an awful fever dream, and then to realise that, oh, fuck, that actually happened. I'd be curious to know. I didn't think there was a snowball's chance in hell that he'd even play, Sid. Were you surprised to see him?
Yeah. He trained, I think, four, maybe five times with the rest of the team. Of course, he's been out for 4 months. He's got back quicker than anyone expected. One of the things that was talked about over the last couple of days when it looked like he might start was whether or not there was a risk of him getting injured again. And that seemed to be the focus of this. And Ronald Koeman's number two spoke to the television before the game last night and said, look, this isn't the kind of injury where the risk is that what they describe in Spain as a recaída, what do you call that in English? Like a recurrence of the same injury. You know, this isn't the kind of thing where we can make it worse by rushing him back. But of course, that's only the physical side of it. Then there's a footballing side of it, which is, this is a guy that hasn't played for 4 months, that has had some defensive difficulties anyway over the last couple of years or so, even when he's been at the very peak of his game, although I think he's more a victim of a structural collapse than personally responsible for it. And then to put him in a position where he's up against someone like Mbappe, and also to have the right back being Sergino Dest, who's also just come back from an injury, there was always likely, I think, to be problems on that side. That said, I don't think we expected Mbappe to take them to pieces quite as much as that.
Eric says, Sid, is there anything more sad in sporting terms than seeing Messi getting now annually embarrassed in the Champions League? Or just looking sad, just sort of looking away and trudging back to the halfway line?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the figures now, and they got beat three in Rome, four in Liverpool, eight in Lisbon against Bayern. Now, this is at home. That's what makes this even more shocking, is this is at home. Their away record's been bad for a very long time. And I think at times it's possibly, it's a bit too easy to do both things. I think it's too easy to look at Messi and go, see, this is the collapse, Messi's past it and all the rest of it, when actually the collapse is at the other end of the pitch. Because there were moments last night in the first half, at least, where Barcelona made things happen, where with better finishing, particularly Dembélé, and Messi must look back at Dembélé and remember what he did against Liverpool in the last minutes, whatever it was, 2 years ago now. And so it's very easy to look at it and blame Messi, but it's also very easy, and I think both of them are a little bit wrong, to look at Messi and think, look what he has to put up with. Because, of course, it's a much more kind of collective problem than that.
Andy, I wonder what you made from someone who watches a lot of Everton to see Moise Kean playing and scoring.
Well, just the fact that he's starting games, he's getting an opportunity at a club that's competing for a title and and doing so well in the Champions League, where he wasn't getting a run of games at Everton. I have to say, to balance that out, when he did have a few starts, he was way off it at Everton. It's interesting to see what do they plan to do with him in the summer. If the plan is to sell him in the summer, then I think Everton would be quite happy to see him scoring goals in high-profile games in Barcelona, if that is the plan. If their plan is to develop him in the long term and bring him back, he would still be behind Dominic Calvert-Lewin at Everton next season. So is he and is his agent going to put up with that after a season in the limelight with PSG? I don't think so.
From a Spanish point of view, at least, this game, the build-up to it has been complete. And actually, I imagine from a French one, judging by the press conferences and so on, has been completely dominated by the possibility of Messi going to PSG. So if you've got a problem fitting Mbappé, Neymar, Verratti and Icardi in there, what happens when you put Messi in it as well? And where do you put all of these players? And of course, this is an old theme that's been applicable to loads of teams. You say, how did it work at Barcelona? One of the amazing things, I think, about Messi, Neymar and Suarez when they were a three playing up front was actually how well it worked, how well the distribution of space worked and how well they complemented each other. But of course, that's because they're three different types of players that maybe PSG don't have, because you had Messi coming in off the right, you had Suarez being the pivot in the middle that the other two played off, and you had Neymar coming in from the left. And they didn't really get in each other's way. In fact, they complemented each other brilliantly, apart from the fact that they got on fantastically well as people as well. They're genuinely close, the three of them. Which is curious on one level, because certainly Suarez and Messi are very different characters to Neymar, but they were genuinely really, really close. How that worked, I suppose, in part, and I know a lot of people who won't like me saying this, how they worked in part was Ivan Rakitic. Even Rakitic was Mr. Do everything for everyone to kind of give this some of the balance that it needs. So then, it asks a big question about how this would work if Messi was to go to Paris Saint-Germain, if they already have these problems.
Sid, what happens to Barcelona now? I mean, they're sort of in crisis. They've been in good form recently. There's a little part of me that thought, and I know we've had this chat before, that despite everything that's happened, they could somehow win the Champions League. Well, that seems slightly unlikely, but does this make this crisis worse, or is it just the same addition to an already existing crisis?
Yeah, I don't really know the answer to that. And I think that's kind of the question that lingers now, because as you say, you couldn't help but think, well, maybe they could win the Champions League. To be honest with you, I don't think many Barcelona fans, and you could probably take the M off there, I don't think any Barcelona fans thought they could win the Champions League this year. I don't think many Barcelona fans thought they could win the league. And bear in mind that Koeman has said, 3 weeks ago, this team is not in a state to win much this year. He then pointed out that Copa del Rey was the shortest route to a trophy. And we all thought, okay, so maybe you win the Copa del Rey as a way of, maintaining some silverware and giving you the platform from which to continue this, what they've been referring to as a transition. They're now 2-0 down in the semi-final of the Copa del Rey. They lost the first leg away at Sevilla. So they're in trouble there as well. So to answer your question, that's why I say it's difficult. There was a sense last night that, okay, this was just the reality. And we sort of all knew it. And despite this recent improvement wasn't against the best teams. It wasn't against strongest teams. And we sort of all felt that there was still a vulnerability there. They could still be got at. And this maybe shows that this transition has to be sped up or at least has to be forced through, because there's three or four young players coming through that are the basis of a good team. I must say, despite that, I actually think it's been curious how much acceptance there's been that this might be a season which Barcelona don't win anything, because that doesn't normally happen, even when there's flaws. And maybe last night helps that. And that's one of the reasons why I think even Koeman probably doesn't get very badly damaged by this, not least because he will point to the first half and say there were moments when Barcelona weren't dreadful. The point is, they couldn't maintain that pace, they couldn't maintain that rhythm, and they're incredibly vulnerable whenever anyone runs at them.
Sid, thanks for coming on, mate.
My pleasure. Cheerio, everyone.
Sid Lowe out in Spain then. So to Budapest, RB Leipzig 0, Liverpool 2. Andy, what did you make of this?
I thought it was a very comfortable win for Liverpool, and it was like kind of watching a normal Liverpool Champions League game. Nothing went wrong. They were in control. 2-0 certainly didn't flatter them. I know Leipzig got behind the defence a couple of times. Alisson saved one, and there was a bad miss in injury time. But After the first 5-10 minutes, they adapted really well to Leipzig's formation. Trent Alexander-Arnold and Andy Robertson looked like they usually do again, but they were given so much space by Leipzig as well to you know, deliver crosses and thread balls into Salah in particular. Curtis Jones, I thought, was excellent in central midfield again. I think the more he plays, the better he gets. And collectively as a defence, Kabak was much improved from his on his debut, unsurprisingly. Henderson had a good game, and Alisson made important saves. So they looked quite comfortable all the way through. Obviously, they were gifted the two goals. And I think Nagelsmann was a bit not particularly generous in his post-match comments, saying that the only difference between the teams was Liverpool were clinical and his team were not. I thought Liverpool, after the first 6 or 7 minutes, were comfortably better in every department all night. And it was kind of like, it was just like watching Liverpool again, and the kind of like the last few weeks and the individual implosions and madness of that has taken games away from them hadn't happened. But maybe it was the escape of the Champions League, you know, with Klopp having written off retaining the title at the weekend. Maybe a change in competition and a change in opponent, certainly in the way they were set up against them, was exactly what they needed.
Barry, it must have been quite a relief for Liverpool players to see players on a pitch going a bit Sunday League and it not being their own players doing it. I thought the second mistake was from Mikiel. It was absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, I was going to say, like Andy was talking about individual mistakes and madness, and it was the Leipzig players that committed those mistakes. Marcel Sabitzer's wayward pass as well let Salah in for the first, and Sadio Mane's capitalised on Mukiele's error. I mean, I'm emphatically not suggesting that Julian Nagelsmann is a fraud, because I don't watch much German football, but that's twice now he's taken on Liverpool in the Champions League. Once with Hoffenheim, who were expected to lose, and did. They got a good thumping. And last night, I think quite a lot of people expected Leipzig to win, and they were comfortably beaten. And personally, beyond his penchant for controversial trousers, I don't see what all the fuss is about with Mr. Nagelsmann. But as I say, I do not watch enough of his team. If you were to only read about him, which is pretty much all I do, you know, well, I read about other things as well. I'm not a weirdo. But just going on what you read about him, you could be forgiven for thinking he's some sort of genius, but I have yet to see any evidence.
Yeah, and Andy, I do agree with you, and it was nice to see Liverpool zip it about and actually play quite, they were quite direct, I thought, in this game. You know, they went from back to front quite quickly. They're not afraid to do that.
Yeah, the second goal summed that up, didn't it? Yeah.
I think what was nice was Leipzig contributed to this game as well, right? There were two teams going for it.
Yeah, they did, but I on the basis of last night's game alone, I would side with Barry on this one, in that the way Leipzig was set up played perfectly into Liverpool's hands. And once Liverpool dealt with, got to grips with their formation after about 6 or 7 minutes, I thought they were in control. Leipzig got behind Jordan Henderson twice. Alisson saved one, missed one. But other than that, I didn't pose much of a threat. And I don't think, I think the tie's over.
What have you made of the sort of malaise of the last few weeks?
I think it was coming, in a way. I think Liverpool, I know it's obviously the injuries well documented, this, that, and the, but pandemic season doesn't suit them, you know, in terms of not having training, enough training sessions between games, the constant flow of games, having just won, you know, the whole emotional push to win that first title in 30 years. And then on top of that, you've got the injuries, which then impacts on the rest of the team and the depth of the squad. Players who have come in, I don't think Klopp probably wouldn't rotate as much as some managers would anyway, but when he has done, the players who've come in have been found wanting. So I think he's kind of had to stick with you know, the tried and trusted ones, and you know, they sometimes they look absolutely knackered. You know, it hasn't been a good season really for Firmino, but when he turns it on, Liverpool are, you know, back to themselves. But I think when they get back into the grind of the Premier League season now, I need to be a lot more, see a lot more before I'm convinced that they've turned the corner. I think Klopp himself last night said we're not children, and just because of this one win, we don't think everything's fine. But he pressed his point that in the games they've been losing, they've played quite well and then shot themselves in the foot.
I think there might be another thing, Andy, and I don't want to make too much of it because it's a bit of, it's an area in which we generally don't go as journalists, but we tend to think of people in football as if they were not human. And in the case of Jurgen Klopp, he's taken the biggest hit that almost any person can take in his life. He had to keep quiet about it because you don't publicize these things. He's been basically living in grief since the 19th of January, I believe, his mother died. And we're supposed to think that it has no impact. Of course it has an impact. I think they lost to Burnley 2 days after the news hit him, and not being able to be with her as well for the funeral. And I don't want to make too much about this, but I think we sometimes tend to forget about things which are outside of football, which do play a huge role. You can't expect, he won't have been as focused on his job that he was beforehand. We tend to over-dramatize what happens to a football team, as if, you know, a few defeats were the end of the world for Liverpool Football Club. And just after, actually, we thought they had come back after they'd won against Tottenham. But they're having such a difficult season to manage. And which is why I think that Max was hinting at that mightn't it be a season where they decide, well, actually, why don't we go for Europe again this time, which is our natural element in a way, our natural environment. In the league, it doesn't look great. Let's go for Europe again for real this time.
I mean, Klopp has said in a press conference that he's able to box off what's going on in his personal life and, you know, put it to one side. But I don't buy that. I mean, Kenny Dalglish famously resigned very soon after the famous Everton 5, Liverpool 4, I think it was, in the Cup.
4-4.
4-4, which Everton won. He said that he knew what to do in that game, but didn't do it because he was just so consumed with Hillsborough and what had happened and attending funerals. He said that was the moment where I knew what needed to be done, I knew what change I needed to make, and I didn't make it. And then we went on to go out of the cup, and that was when I knew, right, the jig is up, I need to quit. So, you know, I don't think you can box off things like that. They are going to take a toll.
You know, in terms of the performances as well, I mean, that doesn't translate into Alisson suddenly making those mistakes, that completely uncharacteristic mistakes in successive games. So, you know, it's not one thing. It's been a snowball effect, I think, on Liverpool's season.
Someone made an interesting point on Twitter, and forgive me, I didn't write it down, but about, you know, compassionate leave for you know, people in the game. And I mean, humans are different, right? Some people find work a great distraction. Some people need it. But sort of this idea, as you said, Philippe, that because we treat them differently, you know, we treat this line of work in a totally different way, you know, because it's such a privilege to do it, perhaps, or because the money's so great that we, you know, ignore those other human things. You know, it almost seems like, let's say Jurgen Klopp has said, you know, my mum really isn't well and I need to take a break, that it just wouldn't have been as accepted as if somebody did it in a normal line of work.
I mean, I know, I won't give a name, but I know of one Premier League manager who, that was a while ago, took a lot of flack, I remember, after a game, didn't deal with it very well, and he was quite tetchy, difficult, and so forth. And I knew him a bit, and I saw him afterwards in the stadium, somewhere else in the tunnel, and he just told me, my mummy died yesterday. And I thought, my goodness. And he used the word mummy as well, can imagine. And I thought, this man doesn't have a right to grieve. He has to shut up and carry on, because that's what expected of him. And And it must have happened to so many of them.
You know, we laugh at players' mistakes. We say managers are in a bad mood. You know, do we have to caveat everything we say with we don't know what's happening at home? Like it's a difficult balance, isn't it?
I mean, I remember myself writing pieces. I mean, when I started, when we knew things which were not to be mentioned, but we understood that this particular player was going through a particularly difficult time. So, okay, maybe, you know, to take our foot off the pedal in his particular case. But very often there's such a lack of communication, which even goes to the fact that very often we don't know if a player is being injured. And we will write about a player having a bad game. What we don't realize is he's been carrying an injury for the last 3 weeks. And he's in the red zone. He's actually doing a service to his manager and his team and his fans. But he's being hammered for it because the club won't have communicated anything about the state of his health. So it is partly that the fact that it has become so remote that we do not have quite the same relationship with that world, which explains that you have this kind of situation.
All right. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll look back at Chelsea and West Ham's wins in the Premier League on Monday. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Monday's games, then Chelsea 2, Newcastle 0. Timo Werner scored after his 1,000-minute goal drought. Jacob Steinberg writing, Thomas Tuchel's hit upon a system that suits this side. He's finding ways to revive players who look lost under Lampard. They have more purpose with the ball, more aggression without it. Barry, he's picked up 13 points from his first five Premier League games. Level with Jose's first five with Chelsea, bettered only by Ancelotti and Maurizio Sarri. And conceded just one goal in five games under him. It's sort of interestingly transformative, I think.
Yeah, I would be reluctant to read too much into this win because Newcastle made it incredibly easy for them. But I've been impressed with him. You get this impression he's still tinkering. He doesn't know his best team yet, but he certainly knows his best centre midfielders. And Mateo Kovacic and Jorginho have been outstanding for him. Brilliant combination. They're almost telepathic, and he certainly improved Chelsea, but again, Newcastle were dismal.
We found it very difficult, said Steve Bruce. The second half, we changed things and had more intensity. I was pleased. There are positives. Barry, tell me the positives.
I don't think there are any positives to be drawn from that. I mean, we've discussed Newcastle a lot. They've shown us what they are capable of. But the fight they put up against Southampton when they were 3-2 up and defending with nine men for 17 minutes, it was just absent against Chelsea. They sleptwalked a defeat. They turned up, I think they expected to lose. And there is no embarrassment to losing against Chelsea because Chelsea are just better than them. But they were rudderless, gutless, no fight. They were missing Callum Wilson, who's a huge loss. And Dwight Gayle, you know, he's quite a tenacious forward. I don't think he's quite good enough for the Premier League. And he was playing as a winger for a while in this game, which is ridiculous. Emile Kraft was just run ragged. It was like Gerard Pique and his pal at right back last night for Barcelona. And he was getting no help from anyone. Alan St. Maximum offered him no assistance whatsoever. And Newcastle they're in big trouble, I would say, because Fulham are looking quite upwardly mobile at the moment. They're certainly playing better than Newcastle are. And I think Fulham have two games between now and Newcastle's next match against Manchester United on Sunday. There's quite a good chance they'll win at least one of them, if not both. And if they were to win both, the gap would be down to 1 point. So I think Newcastle could be going down.
I mean, obviously Newcastle and Fulham both recently had impressive 2-0 wins at Everton. The difference in the two, I think, was that all round it was a collective impressive performance from Fulham, who, you know, knew what they were doing, knew what they had to do, played confidently from the start. Whereas the difference for Newcastle, who played really well also that day at Goodison, and the spirit that you saw against Southampton was evident as well, but it was Callum Wilson who made all the difference on the day. And without him, you do worry who's going to make the difference for that team, because certainly on Monday night's evidence, you couldn't see anyone doing it.
To just mention, Olivier Giroud Only Jermaine Defoe has scored more Premier League goals as a substitute than Giroud. He came on for Tammy Abraham, he got injured. And Timo Werner scoring a goal. And I don't know what you think, Baz. I know he's had a tough time because he's missed some really simple-looking chances. But he's, you know, cliche alert. But, like, he's still getting in the positions. And I think he'll score buckets for Chelsea, personally.
You may well be right. I don't think Frank Lampard was using him the right way. And admittedly, it wasn't Frank Lampard's fault that he missed a lot of the chances he missed. But I think Tuchel will get more out of him than Lampard would. And I suspect he may benefit more than anyone else with the installation of Tuchel as manager.
Mm. And they're both Germans, so despite not working together, all Germans, as we know each other. So that helps him, doesn't it? West Ham 3, Sheffield United 0. Tom, how long until Moyes gets touted for the Manchester United job? Since the turn of the year, West Ham have won 19 points in the Premier League. Only Manchester City have got more. Andy, I wonder from sort of somebody who'd seen David Moyes. I don't know how long you've been on the beat, but you must have spent, you know, time with Moyes when he was at Everton.
On the beat long enough to have preceded Moyes and gone beyond his Everton reign. That's how ancient I am.
Well, you look good for it. are you completely unsurprised by what he's managed to do at West Ham, or are you shocked?
I wouldn't say I was shocked. I'm happy for him that he's been given the chance, a second chance at West Ham, and the stability around him as well to do what he wants to do and to bring in the players that, you know, he always, you know, Dithering Dave was one of his unkind monikers at Everton because of the length of time he took over every transfer, because he wanted to know everything about them himself. You know, even though he might have an extensive scouting department, he wanted to see them all. He wanted to know everything about their personality, which is something Everton have certainly lacked since he's gone in their signings. So I think you can see that influence coming in now at West Ham. He seems to have been given more authority, more license to do what he wants to do, and a bit more trust in him. And I think it's just good to see him recovering after, you know, a terrible run in several jobs. I think, yeah, there was was he yesterday's man? You know, was his best Everton, and that was it. I think he's showing that there's far more to him than we've seen in the last few seasons. He can build a team. I mean, you know, you look at West Ham now and you never expect them to collapse or fold, or you expect them to get a result now, which is very, I must say, un-West Ham-like.
Yeah, it's not one of the constants in life, is it? I'm waiting for West Ham to implode, Baz, and they're not imploding. And Jesse Lingard has been brilliant. I mean, I don't know if we expected, you know, a player that hasn't played a lot to just not be able to move. But obviously, he's kept himself in really good shape and he's been a brilliant addition.
Yeah, he's clearly really enjoying it, really enjoying the faith Moyes has put in him. One of several terrific signings Moyes has made. I mean, I, like Andy, I thought Moyes was a beaten docket. He was an absolute disaster at Sunderland, and maybe that's more a reflection on the Basque caseness of the club he was at than him.
I thought you were saying like Gandhi, and I never knew Gandhi had pontificated on whether David Moyes could cut it again, whether Jesse Lingard could cut it again. Anyway, carry on.
It's the first time I've been confused for him.
I'm kind of finished now. No, really,
that's fun. No, that's fine. I really enjoyed the foul by Chris Basham for the penalty. Oh. I mean, simultaneously making no attempt to play the ball, but accidentally playing the ball a very tiny bit at the same time. But like totally clearing out Lingard. It was hilarious, wasn't it? Chris Wilder's...
And I'm not sure which of his teammates it was, but there was someone standing nearby and they just like threw their arms up in the air in total exasperation. Not even a pretense that this might not be a penalty. I better protest or, you know, plead innocence.
The only quote I've got after the game from Chris Wilder is, it's a long walk from the technical area to the dugout. Maybe he just wanted to avoid the game and just talk about how far he had to walk.
No, I can give you another one. I've had a tough chat with the players, a tough talk, as you can imagine. We create chances, we don't take them, we make mistakes, we get punished. We were the architects of our own downfall, and I think that pretty much sums the game up in a nutshell.
Yeah, I wanted to add an historical note from Mahatma Gandhi.
Oh, good. Yeah, please do.
Well, did you know he was a football fan?
I didn't know that.
And not only that, he actually helped establish three of the earliest football clubs in South Africa in the first years of the 20th century. And they all had the same name. They were called the Passive Resistors Soccer Clubs. And it was in Durban, Pretoria and Johannesburg. So there you go. He was a football man.
And in Burr, where I'm from, a pub crawl is called a Gandhi hop. I have no idea why, but that's what it is.
Did Mahatma Gandhi give second chances to, you know, players who'd sort of fallen out of favour at the bigger clubs?
I would have thought that it would have agreed with his philosophy, absolutely, yes. It's the eternal wheel, you know.
Mm.
So I think you have to go back on the wheel and, well, you never can leave it. So yes, definitely second, third, fourth, thousandth chance.
I thought the lads showed great civil disobedience tonight. We go again. We go again. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Any other business in part three? Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Caught Offside, which I believe is a fellow football podcast, says, can you ask Philippe for an update on the Ligue 1 television deal? What's happened, Philippe?
Well, basically, the important thing is that a deal has been reached with Canal Plus, which is the historic network when it comes to Ligue 1, which is now broadcasting all of Ligue 1's games until the end of the season. And the Ligue 2 games are now being broadcast by beIN Sports, who are working as a kind of sub-licensee of Canal. So on the outside, it sounds, yeah, that's good. They found a broadcaster. The problem is that the amount of money that Canal is paying for the privilege of showing the games is really very little compared to what French football should have got. I mean, the original deal with Mediapro, which went bear-shaped in December, was about $1 billion a year. And in the best-case scenario, Ligue 1 will get a total of €670 million for the season. And in a pandemic year, where the losses of French clubs, combined losses, are estimated to be over €1.3 billion. So I tend to say that the situation was desperate. It's now only catastrophic. So this is where we are at the moment. And a few club chairmen have gone cap in hand to the Ministry of Sports, asking for the government to do more and perhaps bail out some of those clubs, which are in a very perilous situation because of that deal. The worst has been avoided. But it's still a very, very worrying situation. And the TV deal, honestly, as well, the TV deal ends in 2021. So they have to now negotiate the next term, which means they will have to negotiate on a much, much weaker basis than they were before. And they probably won't even be able to go back to the level that was theirs like 5 years ago. So it's extremely preoccupying, really.
Games tonight, by the way, in the Champions League, Porto, Juve and Sevilla, Dortmund. Sevilla on a really brilliant run and Dortmund in a bit of a hole, but we'll talk about them on tomorrow's pod. Also in the Premier League, Burnley, Fulham. That's one of Fulham's two games in hand over Newcastle. And Everton play Manchester City. And then they have the Merseyside derby. Andy, what of Everton? You know, they giveth and then they taketh away, right? You think they're just about to do it. And then you mention those defeats to Newcastle and Fulham, where you were right, Callum Wilson was brilliant, but I still thought Newcastle were much better than Everton that day, and Fulham completely outplayed them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, Newcastle were completely better than them. That's the one thing. I mean, Ancelotti has improved the team. He has brought in better players, but that thing of whenever Everton get within sight of making the next step or achieving something, they completely blow it. That hasn't changed at all. They have been better. And Ancelotti says this a lot. They are better when they have to defend against, you know, the better teams, better footballing teams. That's when Everton have had their better performances and, you know, their results have improved. So that would probably give him a bit more confidence in knowing what to expect from his team, perhaps over the next two games, than the unknown of what Everton team is going to turn up against Fulham when they were atrocious and got, you know, they were lucky it was only 2-0, to be honest. That side of them hasn't gone. I think it's he blamed the physicality on Sunday after playing 2 hours against Tottenham. But I also think there's a mental problem there as well, in terms of getting themselves up for games that they themselves expect to win. I think that's a major problem for Everton. And as I say, when it's, you know, it's against them and they perform better. I think, you know, having Alan back, either he'll start tonight or perhaps on maybe save for Saturday, will be a big plus for Everton. But without Dominic Calvert-Lewin there, you wonder where they're going to get the goals from, because I don't think Ancelotti's selection against Fulham helped either. He had a strange front three of Richarlison, Sigurdsson in the middle and James Rodriguez, and had to change it after about 40 minutes because it clearly wasn't working. Then brought on Josh King. And, you know, but Everton, as a, you know, you saw nothing of them as an attacking force on Sunday. So I would expect them to improve tonight and on Saturday. That was going to be interesting. And everything you write in the build up or say in the build up to that is going to be forensically analysed because of what happened last time.
Can you just say nothing? Can you just sort of just not just go? It could go either way and just keep repeating that sentence.
Even a an injury update on Jordan Pickford yesterday was seen as the feedback was it was part of a witch hunt. According to some of the emails I got, it was just announcing that the England goalkeeper was fit after missed four games with a rib injury is now part of the media witch hunt against Pickford.
Oh yeah, I've forgotten, Barry, the agenda. What's our agenda with the Merseyside derby? What were we told by the agenda bosses? You know, Henry Winter, who runs it, that fax we get from Henry Winter to say, we must all hate Everton this weekend. Either way.
There's so many agendas.
I know, it's really
there's
hard.
There's an anti-Arsenal agenda, an anti-Liverpool agenda, yeah. Anti-Everton agenda, anti-Pickford agenda. It's hard to keep up.
It depends. It depends whose pay we're in this week.
Yeah, I think. We're in the pocket of Big Pickford. we've also, you know, also the why do you never talk about Bristol City? Well, we are right now because Dean Holden's been sacked after a sixth successive defeat, 2-0 against Reading, who are doing incredibly well. They lost 6-0 on Saturday at Watford. Assistant head coaches Paul Simpson and Keith Downing will take charge of training until further notice. Alex says, the most exciting thing to happen at Ipswich this season / this decade? Discuss. Referee Darren Drysdale squaring up to Ipswich Town midfielder Alan Judge during their League One draw with Northampton Town on Tuesday. What did you make of it, Baz?
Well, I thought it was hilarious, obviously, but I suspect he may get himself in quite a bit of trouble for that, because it's not really a good look for a referee to be squaring no, up to one of the players. He's supposed to be maybe the voice of reason and calm.
Maybe it's like Michael Douglas. Like, eventually you just go, I've just had enough of all players. Yeah. And he's quite a big unit. Drysdale, this is from the Mail, he's been officiating since 1988, worked in the Premier League as an assistant ref. He's also a sergeant in the RAF. In Waddington.
All right.
And in 2004, he was named Combined Services Sports Official of the Year due to his work for sport within the RAF. The 49-year-old attracted media attention in 2006 after Bradford City's Dean Windass received a 5-match ban for swearing at him in the car park after a home game against Brentford on the 2nd of January. I hope he... Look, I think he'll get a sanction. I just hope it's not too serious. You know, so many fans saying, oh, this is a disgrace. It's a total disgrace. He shouldn't be able to ref again. You know, yes, it probably wasn't the right thing to do. Interestingly, I, in a Saturday clog of football, was playing in a friendly and the referee started on one of our players. It was very odd because you're just not expecting it. You know, he went, right, I've had enough of this. You and me, let's go. And we were like, and actually, it had an amazing effect. It'd been quite a narky game and it had a really sobering effect and it calmed all the players down because we're all so terrified of the referee from that moment on that we all were just incredibly polite to each other. And, you know, when there was a throw-in or whatever that was like contested, we all went, I think that was your one. We ought to just get on with this. Anyway,
well,
if
he were to get the ultimate sanction, it would be, you know, ridiculous, I think. But it would be a shame that he got it for that. He might as well have gone, you know, full Michael Douglas and just decked Alan Judge.
What amazes me is that he only gave a yellow card to the guy as well, not a red.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because he probably needed to book himself as well. But that's quite a hard... It's quite hard to brandish a card in your own face, isn't it? I think. We'll find out what happens to Darren Drysdale. Tranmere beat Oxford and are on their way to Wembley in the EFL Trophy, known as the Papa John's Trophy. The other semi-finals tonight, Sunderland v Lincoln City. Baz, you must be beside yourself with excitement.
Well, I'm on Champions League duty tonight, so I won't even get to watch it, which is rather annoying, but... There you go. Hopefully they'll get to the final.
Let's praise Lou Macari. 4 years ago, when he was at home in Stoke-on-Trent, he saw a report on the TV about the number of homeless people in the city. He went on to build a homeless shelter, basically. He found a building, filled it with homeless people, got a roof over their heads. Since COVID started, he's moved it into a warehouse and they've all got individual pods. Barry, you showed me this story. It's a wonderful story of a man, a nice man doing a nice thing.
Yeah, that's about the size of it, really. I mean, Lou Macari is an absolute gentleman, and he was a terrific footballer as well. Many of our younger listeners won't be aware of that, but he just seems to be an absolutely smashing bloke, doing something really nice for underprivileged people that he doesn't have to do. And hats off to him. I mean, for anyone who hasn't seen it, there's a film called Marvelous, which was made and broadcast by the BBC a few years ago, which Lou Macari stars in, and it's about his time as manager of Stoke when he hired sort of local eccentric called Nello to be his kit man. And Nello sort of was a local legend who was extremely well connected. And... If you have not seen that film, Marvelous, it's called, I would urge anyone to seek it out and watch it because it will just put you in an excellent mood.
Yeah, absolutely right. And well done, Lou Macari, for being great. Matthew says, what are your thoughts on scrapping 90-minute games and just having a free-for-all until one team gets to 5 goals?
My goodness. How long would we be there, then?
Well, in the thread, someone called Kieran said, what do you do about games like Brighton-Fulham? They played 180 minutes with no goals. Do we treat them like test matches?
Yeah.
I mean, but it's a test of...
Not even test matches, because test matches have results these days. It would be like the timeless test in Durban, where the play was so slow that they had to stop it so that the England players could take the packed boat back home. That's what
in
we
a way, would have. In a way, it's quite nice that if... There would be less pressure on seeing every minute. So it would be like cricket. You'd pop out, you know, you'd miss a bit of play.
Make yourself
exactly.
a cup of tea.
You'd go, you know, you might go to the pub round the corner from the ground for half an hour of the play and then pop back, see if there'd been any goals. Mm. No, it's still 0-0, Brighton 0, Fulham 0. Going into day 2, they'd be like, will this pitch start to turn on day 4? That's a question. what will it be like? Jerry says, question for Philippe. I'm reading a 2005 novel by Jonathan Coe called The Closed Circle and was surprised to see it's dedicated to Philippe Auclair. Can he tell us about it? Great read, by the way. You're so connected. You're so cultured, Philippe.
Mr. Coe is a very old friend of mine with whom I've also done some music. And I played a modest role in at the time of when he was writing the novel. He went on the retreat in which I found for him in an abbey, in a monastery, near where I was born And I guess that led him to think that would be a lovely idea to... It was a very, very emotional moment for me when he said, "I've got a surprise for you," and he gave me a proof of the book, and I opened it and I could see my name in it. It's...
So hang on, if any of us, you know, just want to get away from it all, we just ring you up and...
Yeah, can organize something, the local Benedictine monastery in Seine-Maritime, when you can travel again. It's very good. I can do that for you, Max.
I can hook you up with the Cistercians in Ross Grey.
There you go.
I went to school. How many monastic retreats do I need? I mean, I sort of think when this is all over, I don't really like noisy places, but I'd quite like to go somewhere where there are some other people and I'm allowed to make some noise. I'm not sure a Benedictine retreat is necessarily the first holiday.
And they do their own cider as well.
Right, okay. I don't really like cider.
Yeah. And they're very good singers too.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll think about it if that's all right. I mean, I presume they're not desperate for my they're not desperate for my custom, are they?
You've got to book in advance. I mean, it's very popular.
All right. Well, I dedicate this pod to you, Philippe.
That's very kind.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming on, Andy. Nice to see you, mate.
Thank you very much for having me. Cheers.
Cheers, Barry.
Cheers.
Cheers, Philippe.
Bye bye.
We'll be back tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.